Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. My name is Lauren Litton. I'm the host of Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. That's 347-994-1149. And to indicate you have a question, press the number 1 on your telephone keypad and you'll be placed in a queue to be on the air. Also, feel free to log into our chat room and pose a question there. It's almost impossible to escape the fact that violence is occurring in our schools, homes, communities, and intimate partner dating relationships. We know that children's exposure to violence, whether as victims or witnesses, is often associated with long-term physical, psychological, and emotional harm. In fact, there are many effects of exposure to violence, including placing children at greater risk for engaging in delinquent or criminal behavior, leading to ongoing system involvement. In the face of mounting research about the impact of exposure to violence and the traditionally siloed approaches to intervening and preventing violence, almost 2 years ago, the U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder launched the Defending Childhood Initiative as a way to help address this national crisis. The initiative focuses on promoting safe and thriving communities by raising awareness and providing families with the essential services they need to break the cycle of violence. Prevention, intervention, treatment, and community organizing are all strategies that are being examined and used to provide a comprehensive and holistic continuum of care to children and teens. The initiative has several components, including a national task force and grant funding that went to 8 communities across the country to develop strategic plans for comprehensive community-based efforts and to demonstrate promising practice that will further inform the initiative. We have 3 people joining us today to discuss the initiative and what is happening on the ground. 2 of our guests are from the grant-funded communities, and the other works at Futures Without Violence, formerly known as the Family Violence Prevention Fund, that serves as a national technical assistance provider to the 8 sites. Our guests are Casey Corcoran. He is a program director with the Children's Program at Futures Without Violence. Previously, he worked at the Boston Public Health Commission as the director of the Start Strong, Building Healthy Teen Relationships Initiative. For 12 years, he also worked with at-risk adults and youth in Boston around issues of dating violence, domestic violence, sexual health, and healthy conflict resolution. Casey taught elementary school in Washington, D.C. as part of the Teach for America program. He received his Master's of Arts in Teaching from Trinity College and is a certified batter dating violence intervention counselor. Erin Fairchild has worked with families and communities impacted by trauma and violence for the past 12 years. She specializes in child exposure to violence. In her current role as the Defending Childhood Initiative Coordinator through the Multnomah County Domestic Violence Coordination Office, her vision is a local community that supports safe parents and caregivers to help their children recover and thrive. Erin has comprehensive experience in the grassroots domestic violence movement, child protective services, and children's mental health. She holds a master's in social work. Catherine Fine is a public health practitioner with over 10 years of experience in public health violence prevention. She currently oversees the implementation of numerous violence prevention efforts, including the Defending Childhood Initiative, Start Strong, Engaging Men and Boys, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts Safe and Successful Youth Initiative, the Family Justice Center of Boston, the Violence Intervention Advocacy Program, which is a health-based prevention initiative, and STRIVE, a community organizing strategy to prevent violence. Catherine holds a master's from Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. So I'd like to welcome the 3 of you to the show.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Okay. Thank you.
Casey, maybe you can start us off. I did a little bit of an introduction to the Defending Childhood Initiative. Can you give us more details for those not familiar with it?
Absolutely. So, as you mentioned, this is really a signature initiative of the Attorney General and the Department of Justice. A few years ago, Attorney General Holder led an interagency effort on children's exposure to violence and then convened a national summit that really led to a blueprint for action. And out of that came the Defending Childhood Initiative and all its different components. And really, it's a coordinated multidisciplinary approach that incorporates prevention, intervention, treatment, response strategies, and provides a continuum of care to children from the time of exposure through their successful treatment. And I think it has an amazing scope because the age range is 0 to 17, and it's exposure to all types of violence in the home, in the school, and in the community. And there are really three main, at least out of the demonstration project, there are three main goals. One, we want to prevent children's exposure to violence. Two, we want to mitigate the negative effects experienced by children exposed to violence. And then we also want to develop knowledge about and spread awareness of the issue of children exposed to violence. And I think that's what's happening, both through the demonstration projects, which you mentioned, as well as the Attorney General's Task Force on Children Exposed to Violence.
And we are going to spend a lot more time about what's happening in the communities. I just do want to mention, too, the federal partners on this initiative are the Office of Justice Programs, the Executive Office of the United States Attorneys, Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services, and the Office on Violence Against Women. So I don't know, can you also let us know how Futures Without Violence became involved, as well as the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, who really oversees a lot of this?
So Futures Without Violence has been committed to the issue of ending children's exposure to violence for as long as the agency has been in existence. So this was really a natural fit, and we were a grantee, just like the grantees on the phone. So we provide the training and technical assistance to the sites. We share resources, we share learning, and we're really doing a lot of learning from the sites as well. And I'm sorry, what was the second part?
I didn't know if you had anything you wanted to add about the role of ODJDP,
sure.
The Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency.
Right.
Prevention.
So, it's also a very natural fit that the OJJDP is taking the lead on this because we know that children who are exposed to violence are at higher risk of engaging in criminal behavior later in life and becoming part of a cycle of violence. So they have a very vested interest in protecting children and promoting prevention and mitigating the negative effects experienced by children who are exposed to violence.
So you're speaking about the research. What does the research show? You just mentioned it a little bit there. But why should we care about children being exposed to violence? What are the rates, and what do we even mean by children exposed to violence?
Well, we know that children who are exposed to violence, there's a prominent study by Finkelhor that talks about the real long-term effects of the physical, psychological, and emotional harm that is done when young people are exposed to violence. We know that 10% of children have suffered some form of child maltreatment. We know that it increases the likelihood that they're going to be exposed to other types of violence multiple times. And we know that children are more likely to be exposed to violence and more likely to be exposed to violence and crime than adults. So we have a very solid and compelling evidence base about the real negative effects of having children exposed to violence. And it's not just being exposed to one type of violence, but there are young people who are being exposed over and over to multiple types of violence. And that's really what a large part of what this initiative is trying to address. And the sites are doing a really fantastic job at.
Erin or Catherine, is there anything you'd like to add right now?
No, this is Catherine.
I
think the thing that I would add from the Finkelhor study, and just to sort of underscore Casey's important point, is I think what was sort of in some ways a very striking number is that 60% of all 60% of children have in the country have been exposed to one type of violence in the last year, and of that 60%, two-thirds have been exposed to multiple forms of violence. So that really both that paper was really instructive in how we thought about our citywide planning and really kind of reinforced some of the things that we are also seeing in our community and we want to better understand.
And for the first time, I like to get very concrete. So Vincent, there might be some people who are really hearing about this for the first time. When we're saying exposure to multiple forms of violence, what do we mean? Can you give some examples of the forms of violence we're talking about?
I just wanted to check that's directed to me. I mean,
whoever this is. Oh, it's open to all three of you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead.
The definition provided by the DOJ, the Department of Justice, when we were planning our grant, really talked about any direct and indirect exposure to all crime and violence and abuse experienced. So, child maltreatment, domestic violence, teen dating violence, sexual assault, stalking, school violence, and community violence. So that was the definition that I believe most of the sites built off of in framing their plans.
Great, thank you. So I know because I was part of a demonstration initiative a long time ago that looked at one piece of this. It was called the Green Book Initiative, and so there's been other efforts to look at children's exposure to violence. How is this initiative, Defending Childhood, a little bit different, and how are we incorporating some of the lessons learned from those previous ones?
So I think one of the unique pieces of this that makes it different is the scope and scale of the project. The fact that there are a lot of resources behind it, and it's really taken some of the best practices and some of the learning, which I think one of the key points of learning is that we need to connect the silos of work when we're thinking about how to limit and prevent children's exposure to violence. And the scale of this is we're working both with a task force bringing in experts from all across the country, but also the eight sites that are implementing this are really laboratories to tell us how to do this work in different areas across the country over a multi-year period. So it's this combination of scale and scope and resources behind it and good thinking and interagency connectedness that I think makes this project really unique.
This is
Erin. One of the things that makes it very unique.
Yeah, and I would add, as someone who has kind of been doing, before my role with the Defending Childhood Initiative, kind of on-the-ground intervention work with families and children and youth impacted by violence, it's what's been so impactful for me and exciting and inspiring about this particular work is that to know that at a national level that our kind of our best thinkers and efforts are focusing on a multidisciplinary collaborative approach, looking at how all different forms of violence are connected and how they impact children and youth at different levels. So I think, as Casey mentioned, the scale and the scope is important. And I think it feels to me like there's just a critical mass right now happening on this issue that I feel that Defending Childhood Initiative is kind of at the forefront of, which is, you know, having been on the ground working in homes with families that are feeling the manifestations of what trauma looks like and the way it's impacting their lives and the quality of relationships they have with each other and all of those issues, it just feels like it's coming together in a way that's really inspiring and hopeful.
And that's, to build on that, that's something that we heard from a lot of a number of the sites that we had an all sites meeting this spring, and you know, a large continuum of the leadership from DOJ and OJJDP came to talk to the sites. This really matters to them, and I think the sites know that this is not just a regular grant that went out. This is deeply important to Attorney General Holder and everybody else in the Department of Justice.
And I did want to say that some people who are listening saw the initial announcement that Melody Haynes, who is the acting administrator of OJJDP, was to appear on this show. And unfortunately, she has such a busy schedule and a conflict came up, but their commitment to this initiative is high. So I just didn't want people to think that, that I just wanted to explain why she wasn't on this show today. So before we turn to what's going on in the communities, and especially Erin, Catherine, you can talk about your communities. You've been talking about the national experts and the commitment. So the Attorney General did start a national task force on children exposed to violence. And I know a few weeks ago, the co-chairs of that task force reported to Congress on their progress. Why don't you tell us who's on the national task force, what is their purpose, and what has been their findings to date?
Sure. The purpose of the national task force is to really bring together experts all across the country to put their best thinking forward about how we work on the issue of children's exposure to violence. The task force has approximately 15 members who've met, but there were multiple speakers that came to these four different sites.
Hello.
Yes, so I think we may have lost Casey.
Oh.
that's what it sounds like to me. So I don't know if either of you have some information about the National Task Force as well. I know there are 17 experts that have been on it, and I think he was talking about the four national hearings that have been conducted across the country, one in Baltimore, one in Albuquerque, Miami, and Detroit. Mm-hmm. They've heard personal testimony from 65 people and from 27 states in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that both of you can add to that?
You know, I haven't been to I wasn't able to make it to any of the hearings, but actually during one of our all-sites meetings when all of the grantees were together learning and planning, we actually watched the Detroit Task Force online together, and, you know, I think it was really powerful and moving to hear testimony from survivors of violence and also from community activists and organizers and people that are working together from across multiple disciplines to address multiple forms of violence. And, you know, having what little I saw, as you might expect, it was very moving. And really, I think just like I mentioned, being in the field doing direct work for a while, it just feels like, you know, things are culminating in a way that are really respectful to the experiences of children and families, and you know, that they're being guided and directed at that high level from, you know, the actual lived experience, which I think is really important. I'm sure we'd all agree.
Great, thank you. And I think Casey, you're back. Okay. So let's turn to the demonstration project. And there are 8 communities that were funded: Boston, Massachusetts, Cuyahoga County, Ohio, which is Cleveland, City of Grand Forks, North Dakota, Multnomah County, Oregon, City of Portland, Maine, Rocky Boy Reservation, Montana, Rosebud Sioux Tribe in South Dakota, and Shelby County, Tennessee, which I believe is Memphis, correct?
That's right.
Okay. So I don't know which one of you would like to start, but from each of your respective communities, why did you want this grant?
Would you like to start, Catherine, since I just
sure.
was taking up some airtime?
Sure. So we are Boston, Massachusetts is our community, and I think there were two main real appeals to this grant at the very early stages, and it's, as I think a lot has already been said, it's become more and more of a resource as we've gotten deeper into the planning and implementation. But at the outset, there were two things that were incredibly appealing to us. One, the opportunity to really look at multiple exposures to violence, a real opportunity to bring disciplines together within the field of violence prevention broadly, who had never really been in the same room together before. So we were able to bring our community gun violence experts together and those in the field really grappling with that issue, along with some of our most successful and really cutting-edge sexual assault prevention program. So, I mean, that's just an example of two. So this opportunity to bring cross disciplines together was really something that we were very excited to do. The second piece to this is that the Defending Childhood grant really allowed us an opportunity for a year's worth of planning. So we were able to really kind of dig deeply and speak to different folks from across our community, to mothers, to caregivers,
to young people grappling with the issues of violence. We spoke to agencies, different levels of leadership. So we really got both across. We had time to get a high level and a deep level of input. And I think at the outset that was kind of really appealing to us as a plan, as an opportunity to plan.
And I'm from Portland, Oregon, in Multnomah County, and I know that there's a lot of efforts going on in our community and have been for a while to address what families are facing, different families from different cultural groups and backgrounds and different parts of the county, what they're facing and how we might support as many families and children as possible to have better outcomes across multiple domains of life, so school and personal relationships and family and later more positive outcomes later in life. And because we have so many efforts in our community that are looking to address things, it seems like a perfect momentum building behind the movement. And we really, because, like Catherine mentioned, we got to engage in this year-long planning phase, it really helped to bring people together to kind of all of us take ownership together to kind of sit back and look at the, all the multiple services that we're providing. We've got people working with, youth who are involved with juvenile justice. We have people that are focused on school readiness and early childhood learning, people focused on children and families that may be struggling with disabilities. We've got domestic violence providers, mental health, multiple people that are, we kind of were able to stand back and realize that all of the families we're working with at some point, a common issue that comes up, maybe not certainly for every family, but for many, is violence exposure. So we're able to kind of unify our goals through that lens. And our community needs assessment also, when we did that planning phase, allowed us to gather some really great data that is local, that is compelling, and that is motivating for us as a community to move forward together to address this.
I just want to remind our listeners that they can call in and ask questions at 347-994-1149 or also pose a question in the chat room. And I wanted to see, Casey, if you're on.
Yes, I am.
Okay.
My apologies. The wonders of technology.
Fine. Yeah, that's okay. I thought you were there.
welcome back.
I'm on a landline and everything.
Okay. So, both of you, the scope of this is tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
And each of the partners probably have some philosophical differences.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you start? And in your community assessments, what did you decide to look at?
Well, I think that one of our big questions is we wanted to know, kind of a basic question is, what types of violence are the children and youth in our communities most predominantly exposed to? What are the, what are the kind of the top four that we want to address? And I know that because we were all able to bring people in together with this momentum, with the excitement of having the potential to get this grant, which, always can kind of move mountains. And also, honestly, because we were eventually able to leverage the expertise from Futures Without Violence in our community, which is exciting for a lot of our service providers and community-based organizations to have this national-level expertise. Because we had all of that motivation, people were able to recognize that, like I mentioned before, that violence is an overarching issue that affects multiple outcomes for children and youth. And so we were able to focus on our community needs assessment through the same kind of processes that Catherine mentioned with focus groups and surveys and all kinds of contact with families and service providers and youth and children. We were able to narrow down in our community four prominent types of violence that children are exposed to, and those were domestic violence, so children being exposed to domestic violence in the home between caregivers or partners, to bullying in schools, to teen dating violence, and then child maltreatment, including physical abuse, sexual abuse, and neglect. And in our community, gang-related violence also came up as an issue that was disproportionately impacting communities of color. And we also, I think it's worth mentioning, have a STRIVE grant here, Striving to Reduce Youth Violence Everywhere, which Boston also has. So we're really partnering together on that, the issue of community violence. So we wanted to basically get some data that we could use to kind of move people forward and then to look at the gaps in our community and services and supports for children and families.
Hi.
This is Catherine. I was just gonna add. We did things in sort of a similar manner in terms of, as I said before, the way that we gathered information, and we also built a more comprehensive look at our data, and we were able to communicate that with our partners in the process. And there were a couple of things that came up for us as key findings that really helped us shape how we were going to develop our strategic plan. One of the things that came up for us a common sort of challenge was that many spoke of children not talking about violence and that they had witnessed until they really reached a breaking point. Mm-hmm. And the most commonly cited resources for children at that time when they were going to sort of reaching that breaking point were sort of family, authority figures, and other adults. And other adults felt in many ways sort of challenged by how to help support children when they did disclose or when they did reach that breaking point. So that was something that came kind of loud and clear through our talking and focus groups with our community members. And to that end, training felt like a really strong need for our providers and for our community members. Trusted adults in our community, such as youth workers or teachers, were identified as someone that a child might go to, but across the board, those adults didn't feel that they had the skills and knowledge to identify and respond to trauma. So training needs around what is the impact of exposure to violence and how do you provide skills to these sort of frontline folks around how to help children cope. Mm-hmm. And again, family support was really identified as a key theme as well. So it was help-seeking, training, and family support that really were drivers for us in our strategic planning process.
Yeah, and I would also add that during our planning phase, we were able to map out where services and supports exist for families that may be at risk for exposure to violence. And we came up with a lot of local data and information and mapping about where need is. And so that was also really helpful as we looked at our strategic planning. And I know that I think Casey mentioned earlier thinking about how our responses to different forms of violence from a systems perspective tend to be a little siloed, that, you know, domestic violence advocates focus on domestic violence and sex abuse interventionists focus on sex abuse and people who work on bullying focus on bullying. And the feedback we got from our community members, from families and parents and service providers and teachers alike, is that that siloed effect can actually be damaging or more difficult for families navigating multiple systems that have to, you know, for example, retell their story multiple times in order to get services, and that their experience is that accessing those service systems feels really fractured. And in our community, that's something that we all aligned around, that we wanted our service system to have the information and confidence and skills they need to collaborate together and make that experience a little easier for families and children. And then very similarly to what Catherine mentioned, we're focusing a lot on professional growth opportunities for multiple systems and disciplines and agencies where they're coming in contact with youth and children to figure out what is a role-appropriate response to identifying and responding when children and youth have been exposed to violence.
And Casey, I do want to hear next from you about maybe what the other communities are looking at, if there's any different focus, and then also especially the tribes. But we do have a question because it was mentioned about systems and how we know that we already have overrepresentation of families mm-hmm. and children of color
yeah.
in both child protection and juvenile justice. And while it's great to look at this issue and increasing awareness, but there's more risk of creating more harm. So how is that being examined and taken into consideration in the communities so that we don't further disproportionate minority contact?
Mm-hmm. I might speak to that, and then I'd love to hear what Catherine and Casey have to say, but I'm suspecting that the question is centering around if we know that exposure to violence may or that families of color are disproportionately impacted by systems involvement, and if we're going to increase screening or, you know, we're recognizing and identifying more children that have been exposed, kind of a maybe an unintended consequence might be that more children of color and families of color become systems involved. I'm assuming that's kind of what the question is getting at. And that's actually been a really prominent question in our community because we are grappling with, at a local level, higher levels of exclusionary discipline for children and youth of color and higher levels of, you know, at the adult level, prison involvement, and then at juvenile justice level for youth, and then, as you mentioned, in the child welfare system. So disproportionality is something that's really on our minds here. There's multiple initiatives, and there's actually some other grant projects going on locally to address that. So that's been something that we've really been engaging our communities around. And for me, I think, you know, I can't say that we've come up with a pat answer to that question. Hopefully we'll have more answers as time goes on. But I think that some learning that I, on a personal level, have been able to do in connection with our sites that are tribal nations, and then also just from work with people in the community, is that though disproportionality is it's a problem, but the solution also lies in the strength of people's culture, and that one thing I think is important about Defending Childhood Initiative is that we're not just sort of mandating ideas on high about how we think things should go, and these are evidence-based practices that work and that you need to do. We're actually going through processes where we're involving communities and having people recognizing that culture and the strength that people draw from their culture and their families and their natural systems of support is one of the most profound and dynamic ways that families can be supported and violence can be prevented, and that we can address the impact. But it's a huge question, and it's a problem. So, and real quickly, I'll just add that to address that more significantly, we're actually partnering with a lot of the efforts in our community that are addressing disproportionality in child welfare and higher rates of exclusionary discipline, so that we're at those tables and part of those conversations and bringing it back to how exposure to violence is related to all of those issues.
Terrific. Thanks. Do anyone want to add anything to that?
And no, this
I know you're
Kevin,
there.
I think Erin really framed that, addressed that sort of question very well, and I'll just sort of underscore that in Boston, it is something that we have grappled with in our planning process and really, really emphasized, as Erin said, sort of supporting natural supports in communities and really understanding from residents and communities what works for them, and really had the community define for us what they wanted these opportunities to look like. And a lot of our resources are going to community-based organizations to build trauma-informed practices and structures within the natural supports where community residents go sort of in their daily life. And I don't know if that sort of helps to frame anything, but sort of how we're approaching it in Boston.
And I would also add, too, that when we're looking at our professional growth and training opportunities, so we're skilling up our service providers and we're skilling up even, you know, community members and anyone else who has ownership over the issue of children's exposure to violence, when we're providing professional growth and training opportunities, whenever possible, if our audience is open to it, the training includes information about structural violence, about what it means to be marginalized in the United States and how that might impact experiences of violence and trauma and how systems engage with that and what power looks like when we're addressing violence. So whenever possible, our training and growth opportunities incorporate kind of all of those larger level ideas so that we're engaging people in those very difficult questions and making the connections to, you know, how is poverty a part of the conversation? How is racism a part of the conversation? How are other forms of oppression and structural violence, how do they relate to these issues?
And so, I mean, this is incredibly hard and difficult, and it sounds wonderful that you're incorporating all this. Have there been some changes that you've seen in approaches based on those conversations?
Well, you know, we're still, that's such a great question because it is important to stay focused on direct, tangible outcomes. And we're still in the early phase of rolling out our implementation. So I can't say that we're at a point yet where we're measuring outcomes because we're still going through. We had this planning phase, but we're still doing some planning around implementation. So we're not actually at the point where we're measuring practice. But I can say that, and this is sort of another contextual part of the conversation that's happening here in our community, is that we're looking at things like healthcare transformation and the Affordable Health Care Act and our particular localized version of that here in Oregon. There is a growing momentum to address children's exposure to violence as sort of a root cause of overall well-being or lack of well-being. And I think at those conversations, we're not there yet because it's still happening, but to me that is major policy that is being shaped and shifted in our local community. And because some of the conversations are centering around these issues of structural violence and the types of oppression that people experience in institutions, institutionalized forms of oppression, that, you know, I'm hopeful that, you know, it's not going to be perfect because it never is quite yet. But I'm hopeful that we're weaving those conversations with actual members of communities into policy.
Great. Okay, Casey, while we have you. So what can you share? I did review all the 8 communities so our listeners know who they are. But if you can maybe fill in some other areas of examination and some unique things about those communities, what they're looking at.
So they're looking at the whole spectrum of children's exposure to violence, and I'll highlight some of the things that maybe make them unique. So for example, Shelby County, Tennessee, they have a real focus on working with their law enforcement teams, as well as their first responders, and thinking about when there's an acute situation where children have been exposed to violence, how are they responding in a more effective way that incorporates best practices. So they really have a lot of law enforcement folks at the table. Grand Forks, North Dakota, has a very strong in-school focus around trauma. They have groups for young people around trauma who've experienced trauma or are experiencing trauma. They have a healthy relationship curriculum. They're using a restorative justice approach in their schools. When they have calls about their in-school work, they have the superintendent on the phone. They have the assistant superintendents on the phone. They have a number of principals on the phone. So they have a very strong commitment from their school system in Grand Forks to doing this work in a holistic way in class. Boston, which I know relatively well, being from Boston, has a strong engaging men, and particularly engaging young men in stopping violence against women approach. And you talked earlier about the overlap and the multiple federal agencies that are working on this initiative. And the Office of Violence Against Women, the Office on Violence Against Women, has an engaging men program right now that is at the Boston Public Health Commission also. So there's a very strong focus on that engaging men piece. Our Native partners have, where I think I've learned a lot, is using their culturally based approaches, using the cultural strengths of their communities to address trauma and exposure to violence, and really, as Aaron spoke about, historical trauma in their communities. And they're doing some great in-school work in the Chippewa Cree tribe. Rocky Boy is doing some really powerful youth engagement work in getting teens to really be part of the solution, getting young people's voices involved and having them be part of the solution. And then Cuyahoga County has developed a screening instrument for children's exposure to violence, and really taking a number of evidence-based and rigorously tested instruments and making a go at creating a screener that will be used by people that will then that will help determine if those young people need to get additional services. So I think there's each site has a little bit different focus, but they are really working on domestic violence, dating violence, sexual abuse, bullying, the other things that have really come up. But they each have their strengths, and I think that's what's amazing, is if you look at each of these sites, they really are learning laboratories around the issue of children's exposure to violence, because we have sites that are very rural, and we have sites that are very urban, and then we have sites that are in between. So this demonstration project is going to be an incredible resource for people doing children's exposure to violence work.
How long is it anticipated that the demonstration project will last? How long do the communities have? Or is it an unknown?
How long do we hope it will last?
Yeah, okay. However you'd like to respond to that.
So there's a currently each site's a little different, but I believe they're 3-year projects.
Yeah.
And hopefully some will. Hopefully there'll be some great continuation.
Mm-hmm.
I know the sites hope to.
Right. Well, 3 years, as we anyone who's worked in the community or done collaborative work, is not a lot of time, especially when you're talking about something with at this scope level to organize. You talked to, I think all of you spoke a little bit about community organizing, and that is unique compared to some of the other efforts out there. So I don't know if you can speak more to that. How are you going about it? What tips can you share from communities? Even the National Task Force has heard from individuals, which is powerful. So what can communities do in that arena?
Well, you know, I think that just to maybe speak on a more broad level about what's helpful for children and families struggling with violence issues, and to kind of think about what we know works broadly and then think about how communities can implement that in their own areas, it would be kind of place-based and specific. But we know that, like we mentioned, that culture is not something that I think oftentimes really traditional kind of dominant services may sometimes think that, you know, there's this idea of cultural competency and that you want to be as culturally specific as you can, which is really important, as we know. And I think also sometimes what's missing from those efforts in that conversation is not just how to be respectful of someone's culture, but how to truly engage people in who they are and what they know to be true and what their core values are and what their worldview is. And so any attempts, I think, that want to engage community members in such a difficult and often taboo conversation need to really be localized in what it's like to be who you are and what's important to you and how that may be different than systems around you. So engaging people on culture as an answer, I think, is incredibly important. And then in a really broad way, we know that relationships trump everything, that human experience and connection and loving, attached relationships for children and youth and for adults are incredibly important in building up protective factors that can prevent exposure to violence and then to addressing the negative impacts. So, you know, those are two. I think there are many other things, but those are two things that we know that if communities can engage whatever's going to work locally for them around those two issues, we know that can be incredibly helpful. So if schools are focusing on programming in school, for example, that support social and emotional learning for kids, we know that that can remediate some of the negative impacts of how trauma impacts development. And one of the ways that you do that is through relationship. So, you know, we're looking at things, those are just a few examples, but things that we can do at a community level, at policy levels, at planning levels that don't necessarily cost a lot of money to implement over the long term. So, for example, if we can get school staff can take all the knowledge and expertise they already have in teaching and knowing what kids need to learn and then add social and emotional learning to that and then be able to make an explicit connection to the fact that the quality of relationship that I have with my students as a teacher is going to actually remediate and support them as in their exposure or in their support them to remediate the impact of exposure, that could be a long-term sustainable outcome. So things like that at a broad level, I think we have a mind towards what can we embed into systems that already exist that is sustainable and that can continue after the project is done.
Great. Any tips, just to stick with this question, maybe push a little bit further, for community members, families, parents, and children who may have experienced trauma from witnessing or experiencing violence directly, who want to help organize and raise public awareness in their communities, where should they turn to? Who should they go to? How can they help organize themselves? I mean, each of you, Erin and Catherine, are coming from a specific One is at a county level, one is a city, public health. So maybe you can talk about how that came to fruition and what sort of Colonel's knowledge you could pass to community members that need to think out of the box where to go to help make a difference and raise public awareness in their community.
Well, I wonder if maybe Casey might have. We've learned so much from working with Futures Without Violence about primary prevention efforts and engaging the public in these difficult topics. I'm sure that I don't mean to put you on the spot, Casey.
Not a problem. I have a pretty broad answer to that. That is, there are fantastic people and programs already doing innovative and creative work around children exposed to violence. I think one of the great things about this, about the Defending Childhood Initiative and the sites who are working on it, is that those organizations and people and that work has gotten to be elevated, and that the Defending Childhood Initiative is a platform to really highlight the great work that's already being done, because I think the work is being done, and getting those people in the same room together is a huge step, so that there's better coordination of the work that's already going on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So I know you're in the middle of all of this still, but what have been your lessons learned to date? Some maybe challenges that you didn't expect, and maybe some things that were easier than you expect. And Casey, please, add from what you've seen collectively as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think you brought up one, which was the disproportionate minority contact. That is something that as TA providers we're always thinking about, and it's something that the sites have brought up that they're thinking about. So I think continuing to keep that in the forefront, because that is a real issue. And then also making sure that if we're identifying young people who have experienced violence and have been exposed to violence, that we have services so that we're not having them disclose and then not have those services for them. So we have to be really thoughtful about that. And sites are being very thoughtful and strategic about that, but that's just something we constantly keep in the front of our head and continue to think about.
Mm-hmm. Catherine, do you have any specific lessons learned from, your perspective?
Sure. Yeah, I think, this is Catherine. I think sort of one of the challenges, and as Erin said, we're sort of in our early phases of implementation, but thinking about how we make these connections between multiple forms, multiple exposures to violence, but also kind of honoring and valuing when discipline-specific approaches are really what's needed. Mm-hmm. So it's really kind of how do we foster this conversation so that we truly better understand where things are interrelated, but making sure that we, also understand where we need to be discipline-specific. And that's something that we are mindful of as we try, to develop our initiatives with this lens of multiple exposures in mind. The other thing I would add, and this is sort of on a sort of logistics and kind of practical level, is we very quickly had a huge amount of interest in this initiative across the city, and very quickly I think had 60 different organizations who have stuck with, came to us in the planning process, have been with us now for close to a year as we've started our implementation. But we really have to make sure that we keep this relevant for them and that we value their input always, and we listen and hear from our partners, both from our community residents and our survivors and our members of our community and from the providers who are doing this work.
Yeah, I mean, I would add in complete agreement with Catherine that because the scope of this project, I think, is both a blessing and a challenge, I think it's so critical that we're looking at multiple forms of violence and looking at how multiple people from multiple disciplines support children and families, and then extending that to also to communities. That, I think that's unique about this grant and this project and really important because we know that they're related and we know that there are certain types of violence that when kids are exposed to, they're more likely to be exposed to other forms of violence. We have the data. We know that it's all connected and related, so it's great that we're taking a global view. It's important work, and it's also very challenging to figure out you know, what's the problem statement from multiple different systems? What's going to be the motivating force for, you know, for a superintendent versus a mental health practitioner versus a case manager? So, and then looking at community, you know, the community level and the organizing level. So it does require, I think this kind of work requires sort of changing hats and shifting how you talk about it across in multiple settings, and that, you know, I think it's exciting, but it's also challenging.
So we had another question. Has there been any tension in blending intervention and prevention? And if so, how have you managed that, addressed it?
That's a good question.
So that would be a yes?
Well, I'm just going to give a very brief answer, but... I think that for very good reason that when you're talking about crisis intervention, especially when you're thinking about maybe like people who offer temporary confidential emergency housing for survivors of domestic violence, or you're thinking about crisis intervention for mental health, or you know the kinds of services that people need to basically to get their basic needs met and to be alive and to have some semblance of, you know, continuity, that those services are incredibly important, and it's hard to think about how you also include more preventative efforts and organizing when that work is so, I mean, the impact of vicarious trauma from that work is so challenging, the work itself is so hard, and also you care about people and you don't want to see a shelter bed go away, and you don't want to see a direct intervention not get as much attention. So yes, I mean, I think that that's a good question because it happens, and it happens for good reason. And I think it just takes really, I'd say the answer for us here is relationship, having close relationships with people at systems and policy levels as well as direct service providers. And, you know, I've been in our community for quite some time, so I'm just lucky to know a lot of, I'm sure that's similar for many sites, to just be embedded and know people across multiple systems. So banking on that relationship helps. But that's a really key question, I think, that we need to be asking.
Anyone have additional thoughts on that? Okay. Well, we have just a little minutes. So I think I'd like to hear from each of you what are the next steps? Casey, you can take the broader initiative, and Erin and Catherine, maybe for your own communities. Some resources that you think communities, anyone interested in children's exposure to violence, community organizing, prevention, intervention that you'd like to share, and then some final thoughts. So, Casey, you want to go first?
Sure. So one thing to look forward to certainly is the Defending Childhood Task Force report that's going to be coming out this fall. And that's really going to synthesize all that expertise that came out of these listening sessions. So that is certainly a resource, something we're looking forward to and something that we think is going to be very useful. And then as a TA provider, you know, we're always thinking about sustainability. So there's this amazing work going on the ground in these eight sites. How do we make sure that we're all thinking about how to sustain that work beyond the life of the grant? And what are the key pieces that really need to be sustained? And just that we've done a ton of learning from the sites. It's really been incredibly instructive. There's so much expertise on the ground that we're gonna have this resource, this repository of knowledge, that hopefully is going to go far and wide once this project ends.
Right. In fact, just again showing the Department of Justice and OJJDP's commitment that there's plans to make a national resource center dedicated to this issue. Where all this information will sit, correct, at some point?
I think that's still being figured out. So.
Oh, okay.
I certainly.
I didn't say where. I'm just saying that I know that there's a hope for. Hope.
We will have lots of resources, and okay. people will be able to access them.
Catherine, Aaron. And so what, you know, what would you like to see next steps in your own community, some hopes, any resources, and some final thoughts?
Well, you know, as we move forward in implementation, we are prioritizing based on community feedback and other community organizing efforts. We're focusing on home-based services that are home and community-based mental health supports for children who've been identified as being exposed to violence and who are at high risk for multiple exposures to violence. So we're looking at, I think, something that we're really excited about, figuring out how to prioritize this as we move forward, to have mental health consultants and providers that are addressing the unmet mental health needs of children in domestic violence shelter settings in a way that is really specific and practical and usable when families are at that crisis point. So maybe that means having easier access into the mental health system, starting with a relationship that develops in that crisis point. And we're also looking at how we can support domestic violence shelter environments to make sure that their environments are as focused on supporting the social and emotional needs of children as possible. So we have some specific projects that will link the mental health support to creating environments and shelters that support the well-being of kids in crisis. And then there's, you know, multiple other projects that I won't go into that aren't necessarily domestic violence specific, but that's one that we're really looking forward to. And I think, you know, I think that we're, in terms of hopes, my hope is that kind of how I anchor all of my work is that I really hope that as we move forward and this project closes up and hopefully opens into something new, that we can say and we can see and know that we've really highlighted the importance of the relationship between parents and their children and the relationship between children and their culture and their natural supports, and that we all recognize as a community that that's one of the most effective and dynamic ways to support children to recover from trauma. So we're just hoping that all of our service providers and our systems will have a really strong, clear vision that parents and caregivers are the most important people in children's lives to help them recover.
Thank you. Okay.
This is Catherine.
Yeah. I didn't know. So, I thought, well, maybe you're just done.
I did know. Sorry, I had a little mute.
No, it's all right.
Mute button problem there. But we are really emphasizing our these opportunities to increase capacity building across different domains, as we've discussed over the course of the last hour. And we hope to have delivered about 300 trainings to a range of audiences in different sectors about what exposure to violence, the impact of exposure to violence, and to come up with some shared definitions across our city and some shared practices about how to approach trauma and complex trauma in children. We are really going to be emphasizing building learning communities, specifically with the early child care community, around how we can support them in developing trauma-sensitive environments for children and kind of what that means in terms of policy development, kind of training and practice. And we're going to be training through our learning collaboratives over 90 clinicians across the city in evidence-based trauma practice. So we, our hope, and that's just sort of part of our initiatives. We're going to be doing a lot of work, as Casey highlighted, with men and boys around their role in looking at and preventing violence, and we'll be also addressing some system-wide policy change. But our hope is that we develop some shared understanding at the end of this 3 years about the impact of trauma on families and communities. And I think for us, we really want to make sure and sustain this collaborative. We're going to be putting in a huge investment in capacity building across the city, but making sure that we're able to continue these conversations after the 3 years and really think about what we've learned and how, as a community, we may want to realign our resources.
Great. I do want to give two additional websites out in case people want some more information. One is Futures Without Violence, and it's futureswithoutviolence.org. And the other is right now where most of the information for Defending Childhood Initiative is landing, which is at www.justice.gov/defendingchildhood. I want to thank you, all three of you, so much for being on today, and I'd love to have you back maybe in a year to share more lessons learned and what's being implemented in your communities.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Our next show will focus on behavioral health in the juvenile justice system. To stay informed about upcoming shows, you can either follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website at www.childrenslawky.org. Take care and see you next time on Spotlight on Youth. Thank you again, Catherine, Erin, Casey.
Thank you.